It's building its big biotech building, and there you have so many events honoring Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz.
And I want to say that my mother turned this place of tragedy into a place of triumph.
Dr. Ilyasa Shabazz, on the 100th anniversary of the birth of Malcolm X. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Hi, this is Al McFarlane, host of The Conversation with Al McFarlane. You're listening to 90.3 FM, KFAI, Minneapolis. We're live. I'm Al McFarlane. This is The Conversation with Al McFarlane. Glad to be here and glad to have you along. This is a special edition. In fact, all week is special. We're broadcasting live from the George Floyd Square in South Minneapolis. We are pleased, so happy to be broadcasting and live streaming from the Worldwide Outreach for Christ here at 3808 Chicago Avenue South. It is the heart of George Floyd Square. The world watched the murder of George Floyd right outside these doors 5 years ago. The world is now looking at, thinking about, contemplating, discussing what it means, where we have come from, where we must go still. So this show is the first of a series, five shows, Monday through Friday this week here on KFAI and streaming across a number of partner platforms. And we're glad that you're here. We want you to support all of these platforms, enjoy them, and be part of the movement. The movement is the movement for liberation, for change for our people. I want to say special thanks to my friends and colleagues in the studio at KFAI, but also doing live television today with our partners at St. Paul Neighborhood Network, SPNN, you know them. Also, Speak Minneapolis. We're televised live on Speak Minneapolis and on SPNN. Here's a special. We're streaming worldwide as well through the Narrative Nubia platform. Now, I'll be telling you over the next several days about this marvelous collection of African-American people who are committed to liberation. And they have created, we have created a system, a network, a process for us talking to us and to the world about building strategies, programs, processes, relationships that create significant change, that create a future in which we win. You'll learn more about that as we go. We're also streaming through YouTube on the YouTube page of the Black Press of America, National Newspaper Publishers Association, and streaming on the Inside News channels as well. Well, thank you for being here. I want to say a special shout out to my brother Wayne and Ryan, who are going to be doing good stuff here musically. That's what we do. Well, thank you. So listen, let me begin by talking to one of the principal voices, the principal leaders of our city, who had firsthand, hands-on responsibility to responding to the horrible death of George Floyd, and that is Madaria Arredondo. He was the police chief. He's now former police chief. Here's his new book, Chief Rondo. I don't know if you can see that or not. But Chief, so good to see you. Thank you for being here.
It's good to see you, sir.
And congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Take us back to 5 years ago. And we woke up either that night or in the morning learning about something horrific happening outside these doors here on 30th and Chicago. What happened?
So, Mr. McFarlane, thank you so much for having me.
Please say Al. Thank you.
Just have it. But 5 years ago, I was, first of all, I received a call that evening about 8 p.m. that Minneapolis police officers had responded to the corner of 38th in Chicago to Cup Foods, where they were dealing with the subject, a person who was an alleged counterfeit situation. But at some point in time, the initial reports were that that individual was being rushed to HCMC because of a medical condition. And they believed that he was going to ultimately be deceased. So there's a process that takes place within the police department. I went to City Hall. I'm making notifications. And so it wasn't until after that process had ended, in about midnight, I'm alone up in my office in City Hall, that I get a phone call from local community activist Ms. Nakima. And she says to me, Chief Rondo, have you seen the video of one of your officers choking and killing that black man at 38th in Chicago? And from there, that's when I ultimately, I knew we had a situation that occurred right at 38th in Chicago, but I was not obviously familiar with the fact that she was saying that one of our officers had killed this man. She proceeded to send me the now world-known video by the courageous teenager at the time, Ms. Darnella Frazier, and that was the first time I saw it, and I knew from that moment on it was going to forever change our city, certainly change me, the department, and I knew it was going to have an impact, sir, nationally, but I didn't know to the depth it was going to have, and so that's the first time that I received the call.
You stunned, I think, the world and this community because you moved swiftly to bring charges against the officers. Talk about that. What were the thoughts in your mind? What was the process between you and the mayor to act as you did? Tell us what you did, first of all.
Well, so I want to just say, because I think it's very important, I want to thank Ms. Nakima for making that call. She did not have to call me.
Nakima Levy-Pounds.
Yes, that is correct. Mm-hmm. But she did. And immediately after her call, I reached out to several members in our community. They were members, many who are sitting here at the table today, members from a Unity Community Mediation Team. There were members, elders, young activists. And I knew that we had to convene immediately that preceding morning. And they all showed up. Matter of fact, more than what I had called showed up, which I was so grateful for, because I knew it was going to be impactful for our city and our country, quite frankly. I also was keeping the mayor informed at every step of the way, and I will tell you that in the midst of a crisis, the last thing you need is daylight between you and your boss, and he was very supportive in terms of how we were going to move forward. But, sir, I'll stress to you, the reason why the community was so vitally important is we did not have a playbook for that unprecedented tragedy. We did not, and there was not a playbook in the country for it as well. And so I knew I was going to have to lean on and rely upon leadership, black leadership here in Minneapolis. So
what happened? What happened when you decided to make the arrest and to make charges?
Well, I should sort of parse this out. I had the authority to make an employment-related decision, and I informed community leadership that I was going to terminate all the officers involved. And so that was the piece that I had. There were other wheels in motion that included an emergency outreach to Attorney General Keith Ellison at the time. So there was a criminal piece in play. There was the FBI who was also notified in the early morning hours. And so, but from an employment standpoint, there was authority that I had. And so that's what I did. But there was also, obviously, I believed at the time a crime had been committed against Mr. Floyd. And so there were both state.
Tell me about that. How do you come to that belief? I mean, you are a professional. You're an officer. The sense in community is that the blue line never confronts itself, right?
Yeah.
And you're
yes.
the leader.
Yes.
And the sense in this community is that the Police Federation often is perceived to have had as much power as the leadership of the department. And so from the community's point of view, it was interesting and kind of unprecedented to see you make a decision that you made to as an employment decision and then finally charges. But how did you come to that?
So one, well, two ways I came to that. So one, as a police professional, I have a good idea of what the law is, mm-hmm. and I have a very good idea in terms of understanding what are the requirements.
Feel me when I say I understand you have a good understanding of what the law is, but the skeptic in me says, when has that ever mattered?
Yeah.
When does that matter when it comes to us?
Yeah. So as a human being, after watching that video for the first time, a human being was murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't need a law degree to tell me that. I believed my own eyes. And the grace and humanity that I have for other human beings told me that Derek Chauvin murdered Mr. Floyd, and he has to be held to account for that.
I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland, a special edition. We're broadcasting live from George Floyd Square. And if you're in the neighborhood, drop in. We're at the Worldwide Christian Outreach Church at 3808 Chicago Avenue South, 38th in Chicago, here at the heart of George Floyd Square. And we invite you to check us out, drop in. We're glad that you're listening. If you have questions or comments, use the social media channels to drop a question. We'll try to respond to them or post your question as well. Thank you for checking us out. Chief, your book, Chief Rondo, what's in it?
So it's two parts. It's one, it's a memoir. It talks about my journey as a young kid that grew up at 37th and Park Avenue right from here.
This is your neighborhood.
This is absolutely my neighborhood. And so there's a personal affinity that I have for Central Neighborhood 38th in Chicago. But it also talks about history. I'm a student of history, and I'm a student of listening to our elders and the life lessons that they've taught me. And so I really talk about the relationships in that piece. And then I also talk about the journey of being within the Minneapolis Police Department and serving. And then, of course, certainly talk about what you mentioned a little bit about chronicling what happened. It was important for me to make sure that there was a accurate historical accounting of what occurred. I'm concerned a little bit today when we have some revisionist history and people who want to rewrite history. And so it was important for me to make sure that there was a record for future generations as well. But it also, throughout the book, it's a thread of hope and how we come together. We're resilient people. We're a resilient community. Minneapolis is still here. Yes, there are challenges, but I'm thankful when I look at this young man sitting at the table here who mm-hmm. Has cared about this city from very young, early age, and the work of organizations, the Agape Movement, Unity Community Mediation Team. I'm filled with hope. So,
I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland. Let's talk about one of the community organizations here on this corner. It's called Agape. Bridget Stewart is here with the Agape Movement. Bridget, good afternoon. Welcome back to The Conversation, and thank you for the leadership. Talk about Agape, what it does, and what you do now in the community.
Sure. Well, thank you again for having us, Tom. This is a huge opportunity for so many to really understand and know the truth, because a lot of times the truth is overlooked. Agape Movement is 40 years old. It was started by Steve Floyd, our senior advisor. Steve saw a need back 40 years ago to help the youth in our community learn how to love and spread respect, and he started it going into the schools. Marquise, who is one of the co-founders of the actual movement that started on May 26th of 2020, along with Alfonso Williams, who is a member of this church and grew up in this church, and our CEO, Reginald Ferguson, that day there was a call. And there was a call to Black men, especially within our community, regardless of age, all Black men understood that that could have been them very, very easily. And a lot of times, especially in our state of Minnesota, Black men are overlooked and not heard. But on that particular day, the Black men, Alfonso and Marquise and Reggie, came out to this corner where they grew up, where they have strong community ties, and they placed their bodies in the intersection of 38th and Chicago. I came out as a member of KMLJ Radio, and I asked our general manager at the time if I could go and cover the story. And he said, absolutely. I had no idea what I was getting ready to cover. It brings a lot of emotions, as you can tell. There's a...
Take your time.
A lot of healing that still needs to take place. And there's still such a big void for the Black men who are not having their voices 5 years later, still not being heard. It gives me hope when I see Al Jr. stand up for and be such a strong voice for the next generation.
Wayne, what's the feeling? I'm talking to my musicians here.
Oh, pirate, yes, they rob I. So line to the merchant ships. Always after they come, snuff out their bones. But we move forward. This generation, we shall triumphantly. Won't you help me, sir?
Thank you, Wayne McFarland and Ryan Listman. Let me continue. Brother Marquise is here. Marquise, you were here that day, right? And you told me on the phone you've been here every day, pretty much. You live in the square. What's on your mind? What's on your heart? What must the world know about George Floyd Square?
That is a space that, you know, the world comes to pay respects, but a lot of people from the community feel like, what is it actually doing for our community? I also grew up on 37th and Park, and I remember meeting Steve and Spike Moss when I was at Falwell. And then I know when George Floyd got murdered, like she said, it was like an assignment for us. Me, personally, I was just getting out of doing almost 12 years in federal prison because of my ties to this community. And I just told myself I wanted to serve my community in whatever way possible. And unfortunately, George Floyd's murder was the launching point for a lot of us to change the narrative and really transfer that street energy into community energy and really try to put the neighbor back into the neighborhood.
Keep going.
And for me personally, it was me being what I needed at a young age. I was my mom's only child, living on 37th Park. My house was a crack house. And, you know, I found some false sense of love in the community, joining myself with other young broken men and women. And we were part of the local gang that was in the neighborhood. And so fast forward to 2025, you know, a lot of us just came out here with just to see what was going on. And I remember personally, I came on a Wednesday, which was May 27th, because my job at the Family Dollar was, the windows were busted, and then they just sent us home. And then I just came on the block, and I stood on this corner of the church and just kind of just watched and saw what was going on. I seen Reggie across the street, I seen Fonzo at the church, and we had been knowing each other forever. And something just clicked that day. We just really started talking, and, I think I went back to work the next day. Let me back up a little bit. Matter of fact, it was a bunch of flowers where that roundabout is at, and people were driving over the flowers, and people felt like that was disrespectful. Mm-hmm. So somebody said, put a car right here, and put a car by the alley right there. That's what formed the barricades. And, you know, if somebody put another car out by the alley, and then I think somebody put a bus or something down there. And that's where the barricades began, which are now where the fists are represented.
Yeah. And that's the creation of George Floyd Square.
The way I see it, yes. Yeah. I mean, I stood out here with our lifelong resident, Billy Tyson. We were just talking on the corner like, man, what's going on? Because I didn't really know what was going on Tuesday. I didn't come that Tuesday, but I called Billy, one of the guys that is one of the co-owners of the store, and asked him what happened. Because if anything happens on 38th Chicago, all the locals are going to get called, like, man, what happened over there? And I was one of them. And, I'm just recently coming home from federal prison, so I couldn't move around like everybody else. I was on some intense... I was actually in a halfway house, matter of fact, at the VOA. So all I could do was go to work and go home, and... That's just really how my story began. I really just started going to the parks, Phelps, King Park, Central, just to volunteer, Sabathany, just to see how I can volunteer for my neighborhood. And, you know, George Floyd gave us, a lot of us from the neighborhood that were part of the brokenness, a real platform to kind of show the changes that we have made. Mm-hmm. And yet people still didn't honestly believe it.
Where were you when it happened? When you got the word that this murder had taken place, where were you? And what information did you take in your mind, your heart, your spirit?
I got a call later that day, and I was staying with my uncle. May 25th. I was at my uncle's house on 58th over there by Boston Terrace. I was staying at my uncle's. Late that night, somebody called me, asked me what happened on 30th Chicago. I was like, I don't know. But by the time I got to work the next day at the Family Dollar, that's when I knew something tragic happened. And this is probably like 8 o'clock in the morning that I called the owner of the store to ask him what happened. Mm. Because I had been knowing Billy since they got here in probably, 88, 89? Mm-hmm. And I got it from one of the owner's mouth that, you know, somebody died. Basically, is what he was trying to tell me. Somebody died. No, somebody got killed. Mm.
Yeah.
It's a difference. Mm.
Huge difference. I can remember being at home watching WCCO News 10:30. As everyone who's in media knows, you watch media all day long to see what's going on locally and worldwide. And I can recall the anchor saying that a man had died. He had a medical emergency, and he died while he was in custody. And I was like, that's kind of odd. They're not telling us more. They're not saying anything more about it. But then by time 4:30 news came on, my phone was ringing off the hook. A lot of people, I used to be the cheerleading coach at Phelps Park, so a lot of the families are still in this area, and they had reached out. And I wasn't quite sure if what they were telling me was actually true. And then you saw a different story that came out. And instantly, like I said before, I got really emotional, and I apologize to everybody, but it's raw.
So when you saw the tape, mm-hmm. Did you hear about it first or see it first?
I saw it first.
Marquis, same thing with you. When you saw the tape, did you hear about it first or did you see it first?
I probably saw it first.
So what happened when you saw the tape? What were you thinking? What were you feeling?
For me, I instantly thought of my son. And I thought of my son who played football just a block away from this store. And I thought about the young girls that I coached on the cheerleading team just a block away at Phelps Park. And I thought about those families and how did we get here? But then I took a step back and I thought, we've been here 10 times before. We've seen this every year from 2010. This makes number 11 because we had to add in Justine. And I thought, all I could think was, why are we here?
Take a minute and set with that. 10 times, what do you mean by that?
So from 2010 to 2020, once a year, residents in the city and across the state, if you watched the news, you were shown Minneapolis Police Department, St. Paul Police Department, Falcon Heights Police Department killing a black man. Harming black men.
Say the names that come to mind.
Philando Castile, Jamar Clark, Courtney Williams.
Terrence Franklin. I mean, I go back to 1990 when Tysel Nelson was killed by the North Minneapolis police.
Tysel Nelson.
Theodore Bobo got killed by the police in South Minneapolis.
Murphy Ranks.
It goes way back there for me with my disdain for the police.
So, Chief, what kind of police department do we have? What was it? And what is it saying about us that we have to recite these deaths that we feel are murders by those we pay to protect us?
Yeah, so I think the police department we have, to many,
to much of an extent, is kind of what the system gives us. And in many ways, it's working within the system it was originally intended to do. And that's the difficult part of trying to make the change, to change these broken systems. And that's why when they're reciting the names of these individuals, that's the pain that our community has felt. I personally believe that, and while it is a monumental moment in terms of the murder of Mr. Floyd, I think the reaction to his killing wasn't just his. I think that it was a culmination of decades of community, mm-hmm. Screaming, crying, literally, to say, we need you as a police department to listen and change. And so that is the police department we have today. I just want to recall, I remember being over in North Minneapolis at an event your auntie hosted with young black young people over there. And a young man in the back of the room said to me, and I'll still, as a matter of fact, I even put it in the book, but he says, Chief Rondo, I'm tired of slow justice. And what he meant by that was, while I certainly think that there's been incremental change, he's saying that slow justice for him means lives are being lost. Mm-hmm. And how much longer do we have to wait? And so that's a reality. And so it is my hope that we continue to have to do the hard work, because we're going to have to do that. But I just don't want us as a society to sleepwalk ourselves into the next tragedy. So we have to learn from the past.
I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland, broadcasting live from George Floyd Square. We're at the corner, 3808 Chicago Avenue. This is the Worldwide Christian Outreach Center, and we invite you to check us out, to drop in. We want to thank especially Pastor Curtis Farrar for his almost 50 years of leadership in this community. Some of his members were all around as this event went down, and they've been here ever since, still building and encouraging and supporting the community. And we're going to come back and talk more about this. Let's take a musical break. Wayne? Ryan and you guys did a wonderful tune called Enough is Enough. Can you do that now?
Sure.
Yeah. Let's check it out.
Are you ready? Oh, Queen Justice,
where are you?
Distraction.
Well, thank you, Wayne. That's a powerful message. Thank you so much. I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland. We're broadcasting live from George Floyd Square with Worldwide Outreach for Christ here at 3808 Chicago Avenue South. Worldwide Outreach for Christ. The pastor is Pastor Curtis Farrar. We thank him and his team for giving us the space. We'll be here all week, every day, 1 o'clock, live broadcasting here on KFAI, live broadcasting on cable television in Minneapolis and St. Paul through SPNN in St. Paul and through Speak Minneapolis in Minneapolis. We're also streaming this program on the Nubia Narrative Network. It's a conscious community of African-American people, the people who raise the question, what will it do to free us? That's what we're about now, is discussing what will these conversations, what will our actions do to bring freedom, to create freedom for our people and freedom for the world. We thank you for listening and for being here. And Chief Arredondo, stay as long as you can. And also Brother Marquise and Sister Jeanette, this is a unscripted conversation. We're going with the Spirit, so hang on as long as you can. Let me bring two other guests into the program. AJ, people were looking at you and talking about you in the first part, and it's a tribute to the walk that you have been on as a change maker in our community. You represent and you claim representation for young people, for freedom, and for demanding a seat at the table or for creating our own table. AJ, welcome to the conversation. What are your thoughts, what are your feelings as you think about the fifth? Well, I heard this the other day on the phone. Sister Rosenia, Pastor Rosenia Fuller said, we're calling this the angelversary, mm-hmm. fifth angelversary, as opposed to the anniversary. I hadn't heard it before. So I'm putting it out there that our community is calling this observation the fifth angelversary. That's the murder of George Floyd. AJ, what's on your mind?
Thank you for having me. When I think about 5 years removed now, I first would try to lead with the positivity and thinking about all the young leaders that has been created through that time.
AJ, did I say your last name? AJ Flowers. If I didn't say it, I'm saying
Al
no.
Jr.
Thank you.
Yep.
Al Jr.
No,
okay.
Right. I think first and foremost, I'm proud about some of the young leadership that came out from this. A lot of the leaders that was formed through this process, of a process that I don't think, as Chief said, I don't think nobody was prepared for what was gonna happen, right? I remember I was at the meeting he's talking about downtown. I didn't say a word because I was just angry. It was just all rage with me. It was pure rage. It was nothing else. I got an interesting relationship with the Minneapolis Police Department.
What do you mean by that?
well, my father has been abused by him. My auntie worked for him, and she actually sued the police department for racial discrimination.
Let's separate those two things. Number one, I know your family. I know your grandma. Mm-hmm. I know your dad. Mm-hmm. Good friends. And I remember running a front page story mm-hmm. of your father's face disfigured at the hand of the Minneapolis Police Department. He was protecting his daughter, mm-hmm. and they were coming to your house to find out her whereabouts and charge her with maybe violating some kind of an order. And he questioned, and because he questioned inside his house, they decided to mercilessly beat him. Mm-hmm. And he looked like... I hate to say this. He looked like the picture I saw in Jet magazine when Emmett Till mm-hmm. got beat. And so this is the punishment that this brother, and what amazes me is your dad has kept going in the community, not angry at the police, angry at injustice, mm-hmm. but standing for justice and fairness. I know your auntie, a police officer, mm-hmm. who had challenges on the force and kept moving and is still working to serve and better our community. So let me just say that on the side. So go ahead. So you come from good stock.
Right. Yep. So, and I, like I said, I had an interesting relationship with Minneapolis Police Department. So as it happened, I was actually working with a young man. I won't mention his name, but I was working with a young man, and he called me and said, hey, big bro, did you see what they just did to that boy on 38th? And I'm like, nah, I don't know what you're talking about. He sent me the video because he was around the Darnell girl age. So I wasn't friends with her on Facebook. So he sent me the video, and I seen it. And I remember just immediately just having this level of rage. Now, remember, this is COVID, too. This is mm-hmm. during COVID. Mm-hmm. So the whole world is stopped. There's nothing on TV. It's nothing that you can get around it. All the calls that we've been screaming about was happening to us for years and years and years. People were able to ignore it. Because it was other things they were able to focus their life on. But at this particular time, in that moment, it was nothing. It was all over the world. And they were able to see it. And then you had people for the first time, I believe, actually understand what we've been screaming for years. So that's just was my initial thought. But the greatest part for me after those 5 years, I done ran across so many young leaders that really want to take that next step and become that next generation and become that next voice. And I was proud to be a part of that because I didn't see myself going that route. I was outside protesting. I'm keep it all the way honest. I was at the third precinct hoping it got burned down, right? That was my thought process of it.
And it did. Tell about what happened at third precinct. You know, what's important now about this conversation is that all of you have probably seen the social media post about the mansion, the slave mansion in Louisiana. Anybody seen that?
Yeah.
What's it called? Brigadoon? What was the name of it? Brigadoon? Nottingwood. Yeah. There's the oldest slave mansion in a place called White Castle, Louisiana, burned to the ground a few days ago, and the social media world has blown up with black people saying, good riddance, you know, and talking about how dare that community have tried to convert that awful place into a wedding destination and a resort that people celebrated on the blood and the bones of our people who had been enslaved, who built the place. And so when I watched that, my mind went to the third precinct. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's not a connection, but what are you saying?
Oh, yeah. So like I said, you know, I went down to the meeting with Chief and a lot of the leaders that was in there. I didn't say much. I was angry. Only thing I was thinking, like, this officer needs to be fired. And I thought that was an easy decision. And then I wanted charge to be raised. But after this call, and I went outside, I protested angrily, rage, all rage. I remember it was a call that I got from one of the great mentors that I was blessed. As you said, I grew up in the city, so I'm blessed to have a lot of mentors that's in the community. And Reverend McAfee called me, and he said, AJ, he said, man, you got a powerful voice. You're emerging as a young leader. And you got to make a decision on how you want to lead. He said, as long as you keep knocking, eventually that door is going to open. And you got to have a plan when that door opens. And I realized at that moment, and I told him this, I said, I ain't got no plan. I just want to see something burn. That was my only plan, right, at the moment. But I realized over the time that in order for us to really exact the change that we needed, I had to find a way to get a seat at the table. And from there, the DOJ came and the Unity Community Mediation Team. And from that, we formed the Young People Task Force with not just me, but a lot of young folks that are still leading. Liziah Smith, one of my favorite young leaders, is up and coming right now. Watch out for her. And I remember us sitting down, and she was like, and she told us, she was leading us, honestly. And she said, I just want to be able to have a voice at the table. And I remember telling the police chief and the union at the time, I said, for people like me at my age, Bridget, my brother over here, Marquise, it's not too much you can do to change my feeling on how police is. Mm-hmm. We've already been abused. I've already seen the abuse firsthand. It's happened to me personally within my life. But if we really want to try the exact change, we got to change the narrative of what the young folks see. The young people in our city have to have a different narrative, because you had young people as young as 9, 10 years old that had disdain. Some still do, have completely hate the police because we went through this protest time. You got to think about it. From 2010, as she said, that was the era of protesting, from Trayvon Martin on, the BLM movement. So these young folks was used to being out in the streets. These young folks was used to trying to get their voice heard by protesting, but at the very same time, they were just used as that commodity. Everybody would say, young people, no, I got the young people behind me, but they never was at the table and had an opportunity to speak at the table. They just were used. Their intelligence was used. People say I'm working with young folks. So it was my mission to say, if we want to be at the table, we have to create a space for young folks, and not just myself. You got to create a space, because I know who my dad is. I know who my father is, so I know I can get that seat at the table. I always told him, like, hey, man, I'm not worried about myself. I could call you. I can call the chief. I can call Spike Moss. I can call these people that's already in a position, but what about the average everyday person that's walking down the street that don't have the connection of an Al Flowers or a Lisa Clemens, or can reach out to a Mr. McFarland and different things like that? I wanted to ensure that those young folks whose voice never get heard, who are going to have more interactions with law enforcement than most of us because of what was going on in our city at the time, that they had an opportunity to impact the change that happened. So that was the greatest part that I've seen over the 5 years, is those young leaders emerging. Now, and the negative part of it is that I do believe that while this movement that was created and everybody came on the same page, I don't believe that the voices of the people who were actually affected is getting heard. I still believe to this day that black folks, black men, black women, too, are not being heard at the same level about a movement that started with us. I'm just going to be completely honest. It wasn't no LGBTQ that got killed. It wasn't no white person that got killed. But yet, if you see the people that is leading the movement of what's George Floyd, leading the movement of what our people is doing, that is the agenda that they pushed out. I have no problem with any one of those communities. Let me be clear. Mm-hmm. I don't want the alphabet community coming for me, because I know how they come. But this is the honest truth. Mm. You know, the very same people. And then they will look at voices like myself. They'll look at my brother Marquise, my brother Reggie, who in there. And they tell us, be quiet. We got it. We know what's best to move forward for our community. And that, to me, is the biggest problem that started from the George Floyd, is because the simple fact that the reason why that situation occurred and the reason why it was so much rage throughout the country was the fact that we was never heard. And that movement happened. It was a lot of dollars raised. It was a lot of money that was put into the place. And if you look at the conditions of black folks now, they are the same, because they were able to keep us locked into this little box and said the only thing we need to worry about is police brutality. At the very same time we're talking about police brutality, we had one of the most violent years in 2021. I didn't see none of those folks. Mm-hmm. Nobody comes to speak on that. We look at our business right now, our black businesses that's on 38th Street, that don't get a voice at the table when you go down to city council. This is the problem that I think after the 5 years, that's what I see. And that's just me being completely honest, because this is the neighborhood I grew up in. I live right on 31st in Chicago. All these folks grew up in the neighborhood. Why aren't the people who grew up in this neighborhood, who is affected by this daily, do not have a voice at the table? And I think that's because of the fact that this movement was so large. And you can't put blame on anybody, because nobody was prepared for it. I was outside with Jamar Clark. I was outside with Philando. And I remember being out there and being alone at times.
You said those names. Talk about who they are. Who was Jamar Clark? Who was Philando?
Jamar Clark was murdered by the Minneapolis police, I want to say, 2015. And Philando was
On Plymouth Avenue in North Minneapolis, outside the Elks Club.
And that was the first time that I, you know, really called myself really protesting to a different level. But I remember, you know, it wasn't the same energy. I was ready to do something then in 2014, but people were like, oh, you crazy. And then this time in 2020, I've never seen the energy. I've never felt so much collective rage in my life. It's something that probably will never be created again. And it was nothing that nobody was was able to prepare for. Nobody could have led that to where it was. That wasn't a, it wasn't like back in the day, civil rights, where you called a march and 100 people came. No, this was all anger. And it was led by young folks. Mm. Let's be complete. Everybody who talking about, I was out there, I did. No, them young folks tore that thing down. They did. They really did. And that's why I knew that it was important to hear these young folks, because they was tired of it. They was like, I don't want to go sit at the table, AJ. I don't trust the police. Nothing will ever be changed. It's never going to be nothing that can fix what they done to us. They just got to feel our rage. And they showed their rage. And we got the attention of the world. But the conditions of black folks, not just in Minnesota, but throughout the country, has went down. It's not like our income is going up. It's not like our housing is going up, because we were able to look at that narrow focus of just this one situation and not think about the conditions that we are facing on an everyday basis. The thing was about a counterfeit or allegedly counterfeit $20 bill. That's also something that does with economics, right? Why don't we talk about economics? You know, so when I look at this now from 5 years, 20 years, 2020, and then 5 years to this date, it's, like I said, I take the positive part of the young folks that I see that's leading, the young folks that want to be a voice, the young folks that want to do this. Some are people who wasn't. My brother Marquise right here, and brothers like him, not just over South but over North, that has changed their life and used this opportunity as a platform to give back to the very community that they had taken away from at a point in time. Same with myself, right? But at the very same time, I really don't like the fact that our voice is not the main voice at the table. Our plight, our life, and us trying to move to the next level is not the way that we're trying to go. So for me, it's the process of how do we ensure that this moment, that this, that what happened to George Floyd becomes the movement and not just a moment of that time and not just you coming to walk down on 38th and take a picture in front of George Floyd Square but not doing nothing to actually give us some resources back. Don't come tell me you want to take a picture to see where we did at. Stop only coming to us when we die. Can we invest in us living? Can we invest in a positive, in a success? See, we normalize trauma in our community, and people get paid off the trauma of us. I remember Carmen Means told me, she says, you know something, AJ, poverty is a $1 trillion business.
It is.
And when she told me that, it changed my mind forever to look at the way everything goes around, and I realized, you know what, you're right. And guess who is the biggest commodity of that poverty $1 trillion business? It's us. Whether it's death by police, whether it's death by violence.
We get the misery, they get the money.
They get the money.
That's the deal.
So those are the things that I
And so our
away.
Misery is farmed, it's
yes,
controlled,
sir.
It's managed,
exactly.
You know, and we are assigned that role. How do we get free? Where does liberation lie? How do we make it happen?
I think the first thing, we got to make sure that we are pushing a strong agenda, right? Going back to that quote that McAfee told me, and being completely honest, I didn't have a plan, right? I was young and still just angry. I didn't have no real agenda, and I realized that that's one of the things that I believe our community lacks, is having an actual agenda, having exactly what it is that we need to help our community get better conditions. I remember when I ran in 2021, I ran in this ward, Ward 9.
For city council.
And one of the amazing things that I was able to see, I was able to speak, this is one of the most diverse wards. So I spoke to people from different communities, and I seen when I spoke to other communities, they had an agenda laid out for me. When I went to go sit down with them, they was like, this is what we want, AJ. This is what we need. Are you going to be able to get that for us? And if I wasn't, I wasn't getting their vote. When I sat down with our community, it was, what are you going to do for me? I could sell you a dream. What do you want me to do? I'll give you this. I'm going to give you that just to get elected. But if we have an ability and really come together, first we got to come together as a community. We got to make sure that we're moving for the betterment of all. Right? It can't be no big eyes, little use. And then we have to build a real agenda so that when people come to us, elected officials, police chiefs, news people, we have an agenda and demands that we want to get met. We had an opportunity of a lifetime in 2020. We just didn't know what to ask for. Me, I was saying reparations, cut the check, right? You know, that's my mentality. You know, cut the check. Give us our reparations. But at the same time, everybody else had different things. And if we can find a way not to try to poo-poo one issue, we have so many issues as black folks. So I'm not going to get mad at you if you say that the biggest issue you believe we face is the criminal justice system. And I'm not going to get mad at you if you say the biggest issue you believe we face is the violence that we inflict upon each other. I will not get mad if you say drugs, housing, economics. All of those are issues that we have. It's plenty of them, but we need to get fixed all the way. See, we cut up all over the place, Mr. McFarland. We've been getting cut for 400 years, 500 years.
We
got to heal all the wounds.
And we're cut like Africa has been cut, divided by a European convention deciding and creating artificial barriers that suppress the people that own the land and the resources. Let me bring one more voice in. Mark Anderson, Secretary of the Unity Community Mediation Team. Mark, you and Al Flowers and Reverend Ian Bethel, AJ Jr., the team have been at the table with the police department for 20 years. And then Clyde Belcourt was involved in the creation of a demand for justice and justice and reform in the police department. Give us an update. Where are we right now?
Well, first of all, thank you, Al, for pulling this together. I so much appreciate AJ. We've been working together on this Unity Community Mediation Team for a few years now. And this voice from the community about the community has to be what we need to hear in the city of Minneapolis. And thanks for hosting this and giving an opportunity to present this, because as was said, too often it's somebody telling the community what's good for them rather than hearing from the community. So thanks for that. I would just say, first of all, you know, I'm from Minneapolis. I grew up here. As a young boy, I lived down here at 34th in Oakland. Mm-hmm. I went to Horace Mann Elementary School, no longer there.
So this is your neighborhood, too.
Four blocks away. This is the 1960s, 50s. And so, you know, and my parents lived here. They're my grandparents. My grandfather lived to 22nd Lindale Avenue South, had a boarding house, and rented rooms out to the students at Dunwoody. So I know the city. And one of the things I would say is we have the police department we have because we're okay with that. The city of Minneapolis is okay with what was going on. It's not just the police department. It's as AJ was listing, it's housing, it's education, it's health care. It's every aspect of the city, and that's why this condition could continue on year after year after year, because people that were doing okay were okay with the way it worked. I would say today where we're at is we reconvened the Unity Community Mediation Team and the Police Community Relations Council immediately after George Floyd was killed. The next day we called the Department of Justice. They turned out they weren't all that interested in it. So we said, well, let's just sit down ourselves with the police department, because we already had an agreement from 2003. Let's update that agreement. Let's get this going again and bring together all our communities, diverse communities in Minneapolis, and work together and try and push these reforms, which we already had on the table. So we're making progress on that. So we're working. We have a new mediation program. There was a shooting over here at 42nd and Grand. I think was the corner. One neighbor shot the other neighbor. He was cutting down a tree, and mm-hmm. and a neighbor mm-hmm. shot him. And people said, "Well, wait a minute. You know, this is neighbors and in dispute with the neighbors. How do we help the neighbors? You know, when they have these disputes, get so it doesn't get to a level where you need a police intervention. It's not a criminal activity, a call." Because people were saying, well, why didn't you, he's telling the police department, why didn't you prevent it? You know, and so, you know, the community stepped up and we, you know, Unity Community, we stepped up and we said, well, you know, we can do that. So we're working with the NAACP. They're leading this and creating a mediation program. So we're just beginning to reach out. So we just started our first case talking to the neighbors that are arguing with each other and fighting and, you know, but probably don't even know each other. Probably have never had a conversation.
I want to go back, Mark, to what you said about you being in the neighborhood, and that this is not simply a question of, you know, police community relations. It's systemic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I'm approaching you as a white American, as a European. I think this part of town used to be Swedish, right? This was a Swedish neighborhood?
Yeah, there's a lot of Swedes, Norwegians.
Norwegians, okay.
Yeah, we didn't get along back then, but yeah.
Well, and our city has a lot of well-defined European ethnic conclaves or groups. But all together, there was still an agreement to contain and control black movement.
Yeah.
And the realtors,
right,
the bankers,
exactly,
the educators, the social services all worked in tandem, and the relationship was how the system, even though white people were also being abused, exploited by companies, corporations, big industry. Labor was challenged, but still there was a willingness of all to contain black aspirations, black development. So where are we with that? How does the white community look at, how did the community look at black people when black people weren't around? What was the conversation? Or was there a conversation?
Well,
there might not have been one.
I always say, this is America. This is what we do. Look at our history. Look what we've done in the history to create the wealth in our country. You know, and the bond market was created by the slave trade. Now you talk about the bond market and they're worried about, you know, the finances of the government and the whole country. That's where that came from. That was the great producer of wealth in America, was the slave trade and enslavement of a whole people over generations and generations. And this is where we come from. This is what we do. All this land we took from the Dakota people. We exiled them. We said you'd be killed on sight if you came back to Minnesota. The people that lived in this area, the Dakota people. I mean, that's who we are. That's what we've done. So for people, I think, to say, well, that's not us. Well, I think we have to look in the mirror. We have to look in the mirror, you know, and we have to address that history. You know, we have to be honest with ourselves about what we've done and where this killing of George Floyd comes from. It's a part of the American culture. This is how we've treated African American people like you said, the European immigrant community and their descendants.
We're closing towards the end of the hour. I want to thank all of my panelists, my guests today. This is the beginning. All this week, every day this week, from 1 to 2 o'clock, broadcasting live here in South Minneapolis at George Floyd Square. We're at the Worldwide Outreach for Christ Church here at 3808 Chicago Avenue. We thank Pastor Curtis Farrar and his team for making this space available. You're welcome to come by, drop in, be part of the audience here. This is primarily a studio production, but there's space here, and you're welcome, if you're listening, to drop in. In the next few days, we'll also be bringing to the conversation people from around the world. We hope to have a connection to see what the reaction to George Floyd was in London, for example, what it was in Nigeria, what it was in South America. We're going to use the technology to connect our people globally. Chief, I'm going to close with having you, number one, promote your book, first of all. Thank you for being here. But you played a critical role. I'm thinking that the role you played, it's kind of like what I'm reading and learning now. There's a new voice rising, and I may be going out on a limb here, but that's what I do. Mm-hmm. Okay. In Burkina Faso, Captain Ibrahim Traoré is the president of a country that is throwing off the shackles of European domination and control. Freedom is the name of the game. How do we, from your point of view, having been at the center of a seat of power, move our people towards freedom? And really the thought I had was this. I watched over a couple of nights ago a video of the new Pope, Pope Leo XIV, answering a question and a letter and a challenge from Captain Traoré, asking him to lead the church differently, to have the church confess its sins in its destruction of African people and its theft of African lives and property and wealth. And so here, Pope Leo XIV, a black man, in one of the great seats of power. Chief Rondo, Chief Madaria Arredondo, in a great seat of power as the chief of police for the city of Minneapolis, and at a time, at a crucible moment for our city and for the world. Where do we go? How do we get to freedom?
I think the first thing we have to and we must do is we have to look at each other as we're worthy.